Thank you. We're supposed to keep the doors shut so as not to disturb the other offices on them. To the list of suggested readings, as I say, there are no readings assigned. You should add those four. Do I want to make any comments about them?
What's the second one, Progress to?
Progress and Its Problems. Larry Loudon. Well, it's very hard to say anything about the relative merits. Depends on what you're looking for. The one that grabbed and fascinated me the most because it rattled my cage the most was Larry Loudon, Progress and Its Problems. And one of the most important things of that in that book is the emphasis on the other aspects of scientific theories that scientists look at in evaluating them, other than merely whether they are refuted by the facts. And there are many other things that in the history of science are looked at, such as conceptual clarification or the relationship of the concepts of this theory to some other embracing theory and things like that. They really don't deal just with the question of whether you can predict certain experimental data. Are there people here who weren't here last time? Okay. Pass out some things that I passed out last time. If there's still some more.
There's some across the room.
I only brought five because I didn't think there'd be that much. If I'll bring some more next time. That's a propaganda piece of mine. And a master list of my publications, which if you want any reprints of those, you can go to my medical school office in 682 Deal and take them. Well, let's see where we were. Yes, scientific explanation of the causal structure of the world. Pretty catchy title, eh? Takes a certain amount of chutzpah to write a book with it. You might as well be brave. Like, for example, Immanuel Kant, Prolegomena to Any Future Metaphysics. Now, that takes a lot of nerve. I was giving you a brief history overview last time, and I had passed the logical positivists of the Vienna period, and I was starting on Sir Karl Popper. As the reprint, as my Two Nights paper, as I call it, shows, I am middling strongly identified with Popper's views. For about 6 months after I read his book, I was a Popperian. But Grover Maxwell and Herbert Feigl and others convinced me that it wouldn't quite wash. I would say I'm now a hemi-demi-neo-Popperian or semi-Popperian. But he is considered by many persons to be perhaps the most eminent living philosopher of science, at least of that generation. And even people who disagree very strongly with him, I don't know of anybody that says Popper could just as well have made an honest living selling shoes instead of writing Philosophy of Science. he was not, contrary to statements one sometimes sees by psychologists writing about this, he was not a logical positivist, and he was never a member of the Vienna Circle. He was in Vienna. He knew all of the people in the circle, and it is not clear whether he wasn't persona grata with them or whether he elected not to go to many of the meetings, but he was not a member of the circle. He was not one of the co-authors of the big blast, the manifesto. And from the beginning, he disagreed with them. He did not accept the verifiability criterion of meaning. And it is sometimes said that he proposed an alternative criterion of meaning, the falsifiability criterion, which we will be discussing in a few minutes. But that's not correct. Popper never said that falsifiability was a criterion of meaningfulness, not in his earliest papers or in the great 1934 book. Falsifiability in Popper was a way of demarcating what is scientific from other things. That's not the same as saying that what is scientific is not meaningful. In the reading list, there's a thing by Schilp, two volumes, and I should tell you about the Schilp volumes, because we'll refer to them in connection with other philosophers. Paul A. Schilp, ex-Methodist clergyman, decided to make his living as a philosopher. And the way he had a really clever idea, he said, I'm going to take philosophers who are still alive and still writing and thinking, and I'm going to invite eminent philosophers to write criticisms of the of this particular living philosopher. I'm going to ask him to write an autobiographical sketch of his life, especially his intellectual history and the books and people that influenced him greatly. And then I'm going to have these critics write chapters on certain aspects of his views, ranging from students of his who merely want to refurbish it a bit to arch enemies. And then I will ask that living philosopher to write a reply to his critics. That was a very nice idea, and it's got, by now, I think, about 20 volumes. I think, forget who the first one was. I think maybe George Santayana. And so if you want to find out about a certain philosopher, what affected him, and what's the matter with his ideas as seen by others, and then how he handles the criticisms, the Schilp volumes are a nice place to look. Well, in the Popper Schilp volume, which the first one that appeared with two volumes, and in which Professor Feigl and I have a what I think is a nice piece on determinism and related matters. Popper doesn't believe in determinism and thinks he has shown it couldn't be true for the human mind, and we tried to show that, yes, it could. Which is different from saying that I believe in it. I didn't say that. I just said that Popper didn't show it as impossible. And in that Schilp volume, Popper describes how he came by his views. He was in 1919. He would have been a late teenager. I think he would have been 17, and he was working part time as a cabinet maker and part-time as a kind of psychiatric aide, as we would now call it, at Alfred Adler's kid clinic. And there was also in 1919 bloody street fighting between the Marxists and the right wing, and Popper one day looks at the morning paper and it says, Newton refuted, Einstein confirmed the 1919 eclipse thing. I assume you all know about that one. And although you may have information that's erroneous, you often hear it said that Einstein got it right on the nose, how much that star's position was deflected because light being bent as it goes past the sun in the warped space of relativity theory. And that Einstein got it right and Newton got it wrong. The fact is that Einstein's prediction wasn't right on the nose. It was at what we would call about the 10% level from the observed value. But the point was that Newton was out about 4.5 sigma. So Einstein, in that sense, was supported as against Newton. So Popper began to ruminate. What's with Adler here? Adler has his theory about these kids, what's the matter with them. It's always the same thing. It's always the striving for it's always the striving for superiority, no matter what. No matter what, the little creep has got an inferiority complex. And no matter what he does, kill rabbits, set fires, get a D in school, striving for superiority. Freud, in his 1914 polemic, attributes to Adler the statement that even the male sexual drive is primarily a desire to be on top of somebody. It was in the old days of the missionary position. So, but anyway, here was Adler, and you could always explain everything. And he thought that was a great merit of his theory, that he could explain everything. And Popper began to wonder about what the heck could a kid do that Adler's theory wouldn't explain. And here are these Marxists and right-wingers machine-gunning these one another out in the Vienna streets. And Popper thought, now let's take Marx. Popper was a socialist. He's still a modified socialist of the Norman Thomas type, I guess you could call social democrat. And he recognized that Marx had deep insights, but he didn't believe in Marx's overall theory of history. Popper in general is against what he calls historicism. People like Marx, Hegel, Spengler, Toynbee, no soap. And he thought, now let's see, what's with Marx? Marx can explain things. He explained a lot of things. And yet, on the other hand, according to Marx, the proletariat was supposed to be getting progressively immiserated, whereas in fact they were getting better off all the time in the advanced industrial countries. And the middle class was supposed to be getting liquidated, and they were expanding. And the revolution was supposed to break out in the most advanced country because the problem of the surplus value formulas and so on was going to be most acute because of the decline in profit in Marx's algebra. And so that meant it should take place in Germany or maybe England, whereas it took place in a semi-feudal country with just beginning capitalism and 60% illiterate. So, and yet he found that his Marxist friends didn't bat an eye when he would point these things out because they could always explain them. Lenin, after all, had already explained the first part of that by pointing out that the proletariat in England had been substituted by the people in India. They were the exploited class, and the British proletariat was kind of the elite, the aristocracy of the working class, which was not wholly a dumb point to make, was it? I mean, England was already starting to go down the tube by the time of the Boer War. Well, the point was that they could always explain it, though. They could always explain it. Discrepancies between what Marx and Engels said and the way the world went could be explained. No matter what the kid had wrong with him, it could be explained. And then he didn't know Freud, although he'd seen him on the street, but he knew that Freud and Adler had had this falling out, and they could each explain each other's data. And then he got to thinking, well, what about astrology? Adler and Freud and Marx claimed to be doing science, which they surely were not, but they said they had a theory that was scientific. And the astrologers, well, hardly anybody would call that a science, but they did, and they could explain things, and they could subsume individual facts in the theory. So Popper said, what's the trouble here? Why is it that these other people can subsume facts under their theory, can account for them, they can give us confirming instances. They can say, see, look at him. He's ambitious, he's a Capricorn, it figures, and so on. And here's this little kid, he does this. Well, he wants to dominate his younger brother. And Popper said, what's the difference between that and the Einstein-Newton controversy? It's not that these people are not saying something empirical. They were, including the astrologer. Incidentally, if you are in the habit of saying there isn't any empirical evidence for, followed by something like Freud or Adler or Marx, you ought to quit, because that's a very careless way of speaking. Empirical, if you look it up in Webster, means dealing with experience or arising from experience or resting on experience. What most psychologists mean when they say there's no empirical evidence for Freud is there's no experimental evidence or there's no quantitative evidence. That's what they usually mean. And that's an extremely careless piece of semantics, so you should quit doing that. If you want to say there's no quantitative data, say there's no quantitative data. Don't say there's no empirical data. I mean, empirical data means observations. Well, Freud observed the patient's lying there and talking, and Freud's listening. Of course it's empirical. We can criticize it as to how the data are analyzed. We can emphasize the subjectivity of the processing of the information by the analyst. That doesn't make it non-empirical. If you take that view, what you're saying, it's lousy empirical. It's not good empirical, or it's not the kind of empirical that I consider to be trustworthy. But don't say it's not empirical. I mean, when you read the morning paper, that's empirical, right? Okay. So he said, it's empirical, all right. So what is the difference between astrology and Marxism and Freudianism and Adler's thing and the Newton-Leibniz business, Einstein business? And he says that what gave him the insight was the headline. Newton refuted. He said, could I imagine getting up in the morning and taking the Vienna Tageblatt or whatever and saying, Marx refuted? He said, well, of course not. Could I imagine a headline, Adler falsified? No. Astrology destroyed? And he said, well, why is that then? Why can't I conceive of a headline like that? Because those theories, he said, are not formulated in a way that the theorist tells you what will kill his theory. He only tells you what will support his theory, namely the instances that he can subsume under it. He doesn't tell you what will get his theory in terrible trouble, what will get him in hot water. He tells you the supportive anecdotes. He tells you the confirming evidence. And the essential thing about the scientific method, Popper said, was that it tells you what would falsify a theory. Well, that's Popper in a nutshell. Now, to put the logic of it down, by the way, I know that people don't pay attention to the prerequisites, and that's okay. They really should be liquidated out of that description. How many people here have had an undergraduate class in logic? Well, that's better than usual. Things are looking up. How many have had calculus? Things are really improving. Boy, all right. Well, a few hands didn't go up, so I have to do a little undergraduate logic. If P, then Q, call it a conditional, also called implication, but that's not the ideal word for it because of certain problems that arise. If P, then Q, the logician writes that with a horseshoe, the horseshoe of Russell and Whitehead, Principia Mathematica, and they got it from Peano, and he got it, I don't know from whom. This P horseshoe Q means if P, then Q, or as we say, Q follows from P. And the strict translation of this horseshoe is that it's equivalent to either P is false or Q is true. That's the or sign disjunction. That's the not sign, the tilde, negation. Often today you see it not P or Q. And you also sometimes see it P bar or Q. I can't help it. The logicians won't standardize their confounded notation. It's like the statisticians won't. And sometimes, how does it go now? There's one now you see like this, I believe, or Q. I was reared on the Russell Whitehead notation, so I tend to use it. Not P or Q is the same as P horseshoe Q, which is the same as it is false that P is true and Q is false. That's the dot of and conjunction, today often written as an upside-down wedge. It's not the case that P is true and Q is false. That's formally equivalent to it's either the case that Q is true or that P is false, which is the meaning of the horseshoe, if P, then Q. There does not have to be any intrinsic semantic relationship between P and Q when you write that. And that's what people have to get used to when they take a logic class. There doesn't have to be any internal semantic relationship between the two statements. It just, all this thing says is that if this is so, then this is so. And that's equivalent to saying it's not true the first one is true and the second one is false. That's not the case. So that means that either the second one has to be true or the first one has to be false, because if this one weren't true, then this one couldn't be true. Russell and Whitehead refer to it as material implication because of the fact that there need not be any intrinsic connection between the sentences. Now, you might think that's a goofy way to, why would anybody want to do that? Well, complicated reasons why the logician wanted to do that. But you shouldn't think that there are no cases in ordinary life where we talk that way, because we sometimes do talk that way for emphasis. For instance, if Nixon is an honest man, I'll eat my hat. Okay? Now, people do talk that way. And that's, there's no intrinsic semantic connection between the honesty of Richard Nixon and Meal munching his hat. Nevertheless, what we're saying when we say, since we know that I'm not going to eat my hat, it follows from the horseshoe that Nixon is not an honest man. Yes? Yeah, P is sufficient for Q, and Q is necessary for P, as you learned in the Euclidean geometry. Thank you. The relationship is that the antecedent is sufficient for the consequent is necessary for the truth of the antecedent. Now, when there is an internal connection between the two, then the logician uses a stronger notation, P hook Q, or P, that guy is called a turnstile. I don't want to hassle object language and metalanguage in this respect. I mean, some people would say this is always metalinguistic, and that's the difference between this and that, but let's not go into that. Sometimes one says, puts the thing in front of it, which amounts saying, if then is provable in my system, meaning that can be deduced from the postulates. All right, if P then Q, and that conditional relation gives rise to various forms of what is called the implicative syllogism. I assure you, I'm not going to do a bunch of mathematical logic in this class. For one thing, I'm not good enough at it. But I have to do this much because we're going to keep talking about the significance of Popper's criterion. The implicative syllogism, P horseshoe Q, P therefore Q. P horseshoe Q, not P. Now don't get nervous, these aren't all sound. Therefore, not Q. P horseshoe Q, Q, therefore P. P horseshoe Q, not Q, therefore not P. Those are the only combinations you can make. If you another way of writing all those down in terms of the truth tables invented by Wittgenstein and Post, same year, independently. We won't be doing truth tables in this class. This is the first figure of the implicative syllogism. This is the second one. This is the third. And this is the fourth. Now, formally, in terms of the logician's rules of the game, or common sense if you intuit the horseshoe and are familiar with it, this one is kosher. If Q follows from P and P is true, then Q is true. P is a sufficient condition for Q, therefore Q. That's a valid figure. This one is invalid. If Nixon is honest, I'll eat my hat. He's not honest. We can't conclude I don't eat my hat. I might eat my hat for some other reason, for instance. That one's invalid. P horseshoe Q, Q, therefore P. That one is formally invalid. And that one is a terrible, scary importance because it's the usual mode of scientific inference. Namely, if the theory is true, the facts will be so-and-so. The facts are so-and-so. Therefore, the theory is true. Formally invalid. All inductive inferences, we practice it in the empirical sciences, is formally invalid. Those of you who have taken the logic course, I'm sure, heard that 37 times over. One should remember that. Treated formally, the scientist's process of saying, well, if the theory were this way, the facts would be this way, and behold, they are, and therefore the theory is correct. If that therefore is taken in the strong sense of a deductive consequence, it's fallacious. The great American philosopher Morris Raphael Cohen made a little witticism about that, which I have been unable to track down. Apparently it's part of the lore of people who knew him. It's not in his writings that I can find. And he said, all logic texts are divided into two parts. Sounds like the Gallic War. All logic texts are divided into two parts. In the first part, on deductive logic, the fallacies are explained. In the second part, on inductive logic, they are committed. Well, that was a nice way of harping on the fact that the scientist's mode of inference, if you put in a therefore the way you do in a geometry class, is formally invalid. The third figure of the implicative syllogism is formally invalid. That's why all empirical inference is only probable. That's why it differs from inference in mathematics, set theory, pure logic. That's why no matter how much evidence you have about facts, the theory can never be said to be proved in the strong sense of Euclid. It's only proved in the sense of rendered more likely, rendered more credible, supported, whatever you want to say. A when I get to harping on the significance test, which will occupy a large part of the of this quarter, we will be coming back to this again and again and again and again in different forms. Now, this one, the fourth figure of the hypothetical of the implicative syllogism, if P then Q, therefore not P, is also formally valid, like the first figure. If Newton is right, the star will look to be here. The star doesn't look to be here, therefore Newton is wrong. Since we said Q is a necessary condition for P, then if it's false, P is false. Yes? It's related intimately to it. That's correct. This is the format when we use a scientific law to predict a particular event, for instance. This is the form when we use an event to support a scientific law. And this is the case when we use a particular event to refute a scientific law or theory. Now, in the language of the medieval logicians, I don't know what Aristotle called it in Greek, but in the Latin, they talked about the destructive mode and the constructive mode. This they called modus ponens, that which sets up or establishes the conclusion from the Latin verb. And the Latin verb to destroy is tolo, tolera. It's one of those goofy, irregular things, tolo, tolera, sustuli, sublatus. I don't know how those things happen, but modus tollens is the destructive mode or mood, the fourth figure of the implicative syllogism. The first figure constructs the conclusion, if P then Q, P, therefore Q, ponens. The fourth figure destructs the premise, if P then Q, therefore not P. And you're going to hear the word modus tollens at least once each lecture from me, because it's the core of Popper's position. He said, this thing here gets us into the morass of justifying induction. It gets us into Hume's problem. It gets us into the paradoxes of confirmation. If you don't know about those, don't worry about it, but they're terrible. Like confirming the fact that all swans are white by finding a lot of non-black non-swans. And that's a mess. It's just a terrible mess. It's a scandal to the logician. And Popper said, I'm going to liquidate these traditional problems of induction and the paradoxes of confirmation and so on and take care of David Hume and one fell swoop by saying you don't support theories with facts, you don't confirm theories with facts, you don't justify theories with facts, you don't found theories on facts. All those are bad words for Popper. Foundationism, justificationism, the layer cake theory of knowledge. Here are the facts, and then science rests firmly on them. And he said, that's all a bunch of malarkey, and Hume showed we can't do it that way. And besides, it permits astrology and Adler and Marx to pretend to be scientific. What do? He says, we subject our theories to the risk of being falsified. And we do that without any new principle of logical inference. We do it by formal logic alone, because the fourth figure of the syllogism is formally valid. So we don't have to concoct some principle of induction like Reichenbach or John Stuart Mill or Bacon or Charles Saunders Peirce. We don't have to get a headache over how do we justify induction. This kind of business here, the logician says, is ampliative inference, by which he means simply that the thing inferred amplifies, means goes beyond the data. I find a white swan, then I find another white swan, and I find a third white swan, I get a bunch of white swans, and then I draw the conclusion all swans are white. That conclusion obviously doesn't follow from the particulars, although the particulars follow from it. And it's a mess to try to justify that. If you want to read a very smart person trying to do it, read Reichenbach, the 1938 book. I mean, he thought that he could justify induction insofar as it was capable of being justified. It's a clever move. It probably doesn't quite wash, but the justification is so feeble compared to our animal faith that the sun will rise tomorrow. It's just pathetic. You have to have animal faith. Santayana was right about that. You have to have animal faith. Well, Popper said, we don't have to worry about that. We don't have to try to concoct a special philosophical principle to justify induction because there ain't any such animal. Now, I think he's a little goofy on saying there is no such thing as induction. He holds that all so-called cases of induction, when you examine them carefully, turn out to be somebody testing a theory. And I have heard him and Feigl fight about that. Feigl's favorite example was Old Faithful. He said, now, Carl, surely you will agree that that is pure induction. Some explorer goes out there, or whatever, missionary, and writes back or comes back and says, you got this crazy thing, it spouts every, 28 minutes, give or take a minute or two, steam comes out. And people didn't believe it, as I understand it. They didn't think there could be such a geological phenomenon. Well, there was no theory about Old Faithful, and no theory led anybody to search for such a goofy phenomenon in geology. I don't know that the geologists, does anybody know, have they got a theory of how Old Faithful works? How the innards are? I mean, dare say there's some speculations, but nobody wants to dig down there and ruin it, you know. So there it is. It blows every 28 minutes. And Feigl says to Popper, look, that's pure induction. This fellow stood there. There it went again, for heaven's sake. Bing. Well, they never settled the controversy. I incline to agree with Feigl and Reichenbach that there is such a thing as pure induction, and I don't see why Popper believes it to be crucial for his position to say that the thing... He not only says it can't be justified, which Hume showed, but he says there ain't any such thing psychologically and socially. It always just looks that way. And if you bring up something like how... penicillin was discovered. I mean, that was due to a laboratory mistake. I mean, he went on his vacation and left these petri dishes out and came back, and there this mold was, and the germs were dead. Well, and Popper says, but he was looking for something. Maybe he wasn't looking for that, but he was looking for something. Now, that argument can go on a long time, and for some reason, much as I'm fascinated by Popper, that particular aspect of his position sort of bores me. I don't know why. I mean, I'm really not interested in the question whether 2% or 8% of so-called inductions are really pure inductions, and the others are all somebody testing a theory. You have to keep in mind in thinking about Popper's view, though, that for him, a theory can be a low-level thing. That is to say, even a first-order generalization about the factual particulars constitutes a theory for Popper. It's a degenerate theory, but it is a theory. I mean, a statement of the form, for all x, phi x, horseshoe psi x, for phi and psi are observable predicates, and the domain is specified as, say, all birds or all schizophrenics or all living organisms. For every x, if it's a phi, it's a psi. That's a degenerate theory for Popper. So if somebody like Hull would say Fred Skinner doesn't have a theory, Popper would say, oh, yes, he does. I don't believe in Skinner's theory, he would say. I know that he doesn't, but he would say it's a theory. It's a first-order dispositional, a set of dispositional relationships, minimizing inference to anything observed, not observed, and in that sense, it's not like Hull or Freud and the libido, but it's a theory. So Popper's position was that the difference between scientific theories and pseudoscientific theories, like Freud or Adler or Marx, or the astrologer. The difference between scientific theories and unscientific theories, some theories don't even claim to be scientific, theological theories, metaphysical theories, some theories of history. I don't think Spengler would say he had a scientific theory. In fact, he'd get mad if you told him that. Ditto Toynbee. So theories of history. Popper's position was, I'm not saying these things are meaningless. I'm not saying they're uninteresting. I'm just saying that they don't meet my criterion of what science is. The essential thing about science is its falsifiability, that the scientist specifies what observations would have to be made to force him to say, you've killed my theory. Now, he subsequently goes on and modifies that and points out, which he has to given the history of science, that actually we don't always abandon the thing immediately. And he puts in a footnote, even in the 1934 edition, of course there is sometimes a place for scientific tenacity, meaning clinging to your theory come hell or high water. And as you know, I'm sure if you've taken any science courses, physics, chemistry, astronomy, that there are famous examples of scientific theories that people stuck with despite what appeared to be clear falsifiers. One of my favorites is Mendeleev. Mendeleev discovering, he wasn't really looking to make a theory, as I understand. He was writing a high school chemistry book, and suddenly he was struck with this periodicity of the properties, the valences. And so he invents this goofy table with this periodic thing as a function of atomic weight. Now we know it's a function of atomic number, but they didn't know about number. Well, it didn't fit certain values. It didn't fit, tellurium and gold, I believe, didn't fit. And so some people said, well, Mr. Mendeleev, it's too bad for you. You've got some nice-looking things there, but it doesn't fit gold and tellurium, and those atomic weights are known, and so you're out of luck. And apparently Mendeleev, in effect, thumbs his Noah's at him and says, heck with you guys, the atomic weights of gold and tellurium must be erroneous, which it turned out they were. It turned out they were. And that wasn't irrational of Mendeleev. When you have that much going for you and get that much order in that table, perfectly sensible to say was something wrong with a couple of those numbers in there. The other famous example, they're all over the place. If you read the history of astronomy, chemistry, physics, genetics, they're all over the place. People sticking to a theory despite apparent falsifiers and saying, well, hell with you guys. It'll be figured out what's the matter sooner or later. But the other favorite example is from the history of physics, and that's the ether drift. Einstein's theory explained why there wasn't an ether drift. Do you know about the idea of the ether drift? If I got an interferometer and I split a beam of light and it goes to mirrors and it comes back, and if light is vibrations in the luminiferous ether, which defines Newton's absolute space, and we know the Earth is moving, and roughly what its velocity is, it turns out you can show from optical arguments that when these things come back and you record their arrival, you record it by the fact that the waves aren't quite in sync, and so consequently you get an interference effect. And they knew the size of that. And Michelson and Morley in the 1880s experimented on that in Cleveland, and didn't get any effect, didn't get any drift. Now, whether Einstein knew about this is not known. Sometimes the physics, I was taught in college physics that Einstein invented the theory of relativity to explain the Michelson-Morley null result. Maybe he did, but probably he didn't. It's not clear whether he even knew about it. I mean, it was published in an English journal, and Einstein didn't read English physics journals. And furthermore, at the time, he was not hanging around with a lot of physicists. As you know, he was a patent office clerk in Switzerland when he published the... He couldn't get a job as a professor. Didn't have much promise, apparently. So he writes this theory, and as far as the article reads, The chunks I've read translated, he wrote it out of considerations of the aesthetics of the mathematics, certain asymmetries. It starts out talking about asymmetries and application of Maxwell's equations. The current view, I'm told by Roger Stewart, who heads our History of Science department, is that he probably somewhat knew about it, but it was not an important influence on his development of the special theory in 1905. Well, then in 1916, he published the general theory of relativity, and it started going like a house of fire. It satisfied certain tests, like it was shown that the electrons do get more mass as they're going faster, which according to Newton, they shouldn't. And then there was the big 1919 eclipse thing. And it explained an anomaly in the path of Mercury, which was not a new fact. That was not a prediction of Einstein's, but the explanation of that came with the dinner. They realized that the relativity theory explained that. And then there was the redshift. Well, by 1925, the majority of physicists accepted the relativity theory. Not every one of them. And the ones that didn't were not all kooks. There were some first-rate physicists that remained unpersuaded. But the great majority by the middle 20s accepted it. Well, in 1928 or 9, I forget which, there was an eminent experimental physicist named Miller, Dayton C. Miller, who reported getting an ether drift, repeating the Michelson-Morley experiment of the 1880s with what he claimed was improved souped-up apparatus. And it was somewhat embarrassing. It was hard to write off Dayton C. Miller because he was known as an extremely careful experimenter whose stuff replicated well. And the year he reported this, it was his presidential address to the American Physical Society. So that gave people somewhat of a turn. And when Einstein was told about this, he said, must be a thermal artifact. By the time I was a freshman at the university, 10 years later, I remember asking Professor Buchta, who was chairman of the physics department and from whom I took beginning physics, what about Dayton C. Miller? And he said, must be a thermal artifact. I said, well, is anybody trying to figure this out? He said, no, we don't know exactly how to go about it, but we just, well, I say, what do you physicists do with a thing like that when it's a distinguished experimentalist like Miller? You can't really see what's the matter with the data. And he said, we put it on the shelf. We put it on the shelf. And physicists have a term for that kind of thing, by the way. They call it an occult effect. It's a technical term in physics journals. Occult effects. Gremlins, spooks, brownies, you know. So Dayton C. Miller's thing was simply left sitting on the shelf until sometime in the middle 1960s, by which time the big computers had become big enough that it was possible to do certain kinds of fancy analyses with Fourier series and so forth that had not previously been really feasible to do. At least it hadn't been worth that much time and money. And they were able, I don't know the details of this, a fellow named Shankland, I think, they were able to relate certain patterns of the Fourier coefficients to the recorded temperature in Cleveland, Ohio, which is where the research was done day by day, and show that, as Einstein had said, thermal artifact. And if you took out the temperature in Western Reserve University, the Miller ether drift disappeared. So that's a famous classical example in the history of physics with a very important theoretical question. Is there or is there not an ether drift in which the theorist Einstein and all the Einsteinians, which meant 90% of physicists, did what Mendeleev did? They said there's something wrong with the facts. Now, I noticed that psychology students frequently get nervous about that sort of procedure because they have had it so strongly emphasized in Psych 1-2 that if we are honest people and empiricists, then of course the facts have to control the theories. That is not the way the history of science works when you take the facts singly. It's quite clear in the history of science that the way the facts control the theories is collectively over the long haul, not individually in the short run. That's quite clear. I mean, whatever you think about it philosophically, empirically, historically, it's crystal clear that in every science, the theories, when they are reasonably well corroborated, are allowed to control individual alleged facts. That the fact, the alleged fact that would be a falsifier, the alleged fact that would constitute a falsifier is simply not admitted into the corpus of belief. That's a phrase you'll hear me using, admission into the corpus. That just means the corpus is the collection of sentences that you believe in or that the scientific community believes in. And admitting a protocol into the corpus frequently depends, if a theory is well confirmed, on whether it jibes with the theory or not, and if it doesn't jibe, you may refuse to admit it. That's not being a non-empiricist. At what point that kind of theoretical tenacity becomes sinful is not known. No philosopher or historian of science has been able to give any kind of a rule or even rule of thumb which enables you to say, now, at time T3, from this point on, theoretical tenacity is a scientific sin, and probably nobody ever will be able to. It's obvious that such a point is finally reached. I mean, phlogiston is dead, and so is caloric, and so on. At some point, everybody, every knowledgeable person who isn't a nut or a fanatic, throws in the sponge and says, yep, this is too much. This theory has had it. We've got to go back to the drawing board. And if you know Thomas Kuhn's book on scientific revolutions, at that point, when your theory gets into such hot water in so many different respects, so that people begin to feel nervous about clinging to the theory, the paradigm as he calls it, then you move from what he calls normal science to what he calls a revolution, a scientific revolution. Now, whether Kuhn is right in dichotomizing normal science and abnormal science is a matter of dispute and not one on which I have any qualifications to discuss. So the modus tollens, if we think it was an important insight, you have to be careful and not equate it with what Lakatos calls instant rationality, with his throat-cutting gesture. The history of science doesn't act the way Popper says the good scientist ought to act. Now, of course, you do have to be fair about it and not say that every time the history of science doesn't act this way, that's a refutation of Popper, because that would assume that scientists were always highly rational and that they always followed the scientific method, which is false, of course. Scientists have prejudices. They like their advisor or they hate him, or they went to a Freudian school or a behaviorist school, or they like math or they don't like math, and so on. Or even they like this particular apparatus, or they're fond of the Rorschach or the MMPI. Now, all of that stuff plays a role, not to mention deeper things like what sex you are, or whether you're gay or straight, and whether you're a socialist or a libertarian, and so on. Now, nobody maintains, even people who have a stereotyped view of the scientific method, that each individual scientist always accords with it. So it wouldn't be fair to say to Popper, well, this scientist stuck to his guns and he had all those facts against him, because the right answer might be there, well, he shouldn't have. In the case of Mendeleev and Einstein, he should have. No rule of scientific procedure about when a theory is in such bad trouble we should drop it, no rule about scientific procedure will ever guarantee that you get at the true answer anyway, right? Because it's an inherently statistical problem. Sometimes I've seen objections made to efforts to write rational reconstructions of science on the grounds that one can find exceptions, and it doesn't always work, what's being proposed. P.K. Feyerabend has made that argument. I really don't find that argument very convincing, because there are all kinds of decisions that we make rationally on the basis of what's a good policy. That doesn't mean, if it turns out the wrong way, that we were doing something irrational, right? I buy life insurance. Did I mention this last time? The life insurance case. I have a wife and four children, and my wife is not a career type and has no saleable skills. And so we decide for economic security that if I have a coronary, I get by a truck, why we should have some life insurance. So I buy a bunch of life insurance. It's very rational to do so. Only trouble is I live to be 103. And my wife and four kids predecease me, so the state of Minnesota gets the dough. Now, we say, well, it turned out that that was not a wise move. But we don't look back and say it was irrational to have done it when I did it. Just as it may be highly rational to put a C on Blue Nose to place in the third, and he breaks his leg coming around the bend. That doesn't mean you made an irrational bet. It just means you had to run a piece of bad luck. So any kind of reconstruction of science that prescribes sort of rule of thumb things, guidelines, not strict rules, like four refuters, done. That, we can't do that kind of thing. Nobody's trying to do that. In fact, even the logical positivists didn't try to do it that way. Any guidelines or rough principles, rules of thumb, what you could call friendly advice to the working scientist, is only what its claim can be is merely statistically this tends to pay. What? Like fastening your seatbelt tends to pay, buying life insurance tends to pay, and going to graduate school at Minnesota rather than West Fallopian Teachers College tends to pay, and so on. That's all. That's all you can do. A scientific method dealing with the empirical world cannot be like formal logic and set theory and mathematics, because it's not deductive in that sense. All right, that was Popper's big insight. We take care of David Hume. We don't have a problem of induction because there ain't any such animal. And what the scientist is obliged to do is to specify under what conditions he would consider his theory to have been falsified. The falsifiability criterion of demarcation, not of meaning, of demarcation. How you demarcate scientific from unscientific theories. Well, Popper realized that didn't quite say everything that we want to say about theories that have been tested. And he realized that even in the 1934 book. It seems like a terribly weak thing to say about a theory it hasn't been slain yet. And it seems rather obvious that the scientist does put more credence or reliance or have more faith in some theories than others, even though the two theories have both as yet escaped falsification. And Popper realized that. He had to do something about that. He didn't want to do the confirmation or support business that Rudolf Carnap was working on. Carnap was trying to figure out a logical system in which you could say how much evidentiary support the theory got, and he was even talking about an ideal language in which you could compute the probability of the theory P on the evidence, or the theory H on the evidence E. He had a thing called C star. God forbid we should go into Carnap's C star thing, but he had a thing called C star confirmation, which was the probability of the hypothesis on the evidence. And it was theoretically capable of yielding a number so that I could say, well, on the present evidence, the probability of the theory of evolution is 0.93. And it didn't work, but it was a probability. He wanted it to have the properties of a probability, such as you rely on it at Vegas or in buying life insurance. A numerical value from 0 to 1, which would give fair betting odds on the theory. And Popper said, that's a bunch of baloney, you can't do that. And Popper kept writing articles proving that Carnap's system was internally inconsistent. And then Carnap or his student Bar Hillel would write an article saying it wasn't inconsistent. And I don't know what finally happened with that one. But Popper realized that we do clearly say something a little more about two theories that haven't been killed than that they have both not been killed. Furthermore, everybody realizes that even if the theorist could confine himself to that by a great act of mental purity and say, oh, that's all I'm going to say, I can't answer David Hume, all I'm going to say about my theory is you haven't killed it yet. You haven't killed it yet, that's all. Once in a while, you find a very compulsive scientist who almost does that, even if he has not read Popper, who says that the results so far remain consistent with, you see that locution among physicists and chemists and geneticists, the results are consistent with, meaning we haven't found an inconsistency, meaning we're not in the fourth figure of the implicative syllogism. But Popper realized that there is a kind of rough ordering of theories as to their merits, that we do go beyond saying, not slain yet. So he wanted to do justice to that, and he introduced the concept of corroboration. Now, this is not just some kind of of demarcation, not of meaning, of demarcation. How you demarcate scientific from unscientific theories. Well, Popper realized that didn't quite say everything that we want to say about theories that have been tested. And he realized that even in the 1934 book. It seems like a terribly weak thing to say about a theory it hasn't been slain yet. And it seems rather obvious that the scientist does put more credence or reliance or have more faith in some theories than others, even though the two theories have both as yet escaped falsification. And Popper realized that. He had to do something about that. He didn't want to do the confirmation or support business that Rudolf Carnap was working on. Carnap was trying to figure out a logical system in which you could say how much evidentiary support the theory got. And he was even talking about an ideal language in which you could compute the probability of the theory P on the evidence, or the theory H on the evidence E. He had a thing called C star. God forbid we should go into Carnap's C star thing, but he had a thing called C star confirmation, which was the probability of the hypothesis on the evidence. And it was theoretically capable of yielding a number so that I could say, well, on the present evidence, the probability of the theory of evolution is 0.93. And it didn't work, but it was a probability. He wanted it to have the properties of a probability, such as you rely on it at Vegas or in buying life insurance. A numerical value from 0 to 1, which would give fair betting odds on the theory. And Popper said, that's a bunch of baloney, you can't do that. And Popper kept writing articles proving that Carnap's system was internally inconsistent. And then Carnap or his student Bar Hillel would write an article saying it wasn't inconsistent, and I don't know what finally happened with that one. But Popper realized that we do clearly say something a little more about two theories that haven't been killed than that they have both not been killed. Furthermore, everybody realizes that even if the theorist could confine himself to that by a great act of mental purity and say, oh, that's all I'm going to say. I can't answer David Hume. All I'm going to say about my theory is you haven't killed it yet. You haven't killed it yet. That's all. Once in a while, you find a very compulsive scientist who almost does that, even if he has not read Popper, who says that the results so far remain consistent with. You see that locution among physicists and chemists and geneticists? The results are consistent with, meaning we haven't found an inconsistency, meaning we're not in the fourth figure of the implicative syllogism. But Popper realized that there is a kind of rough ordering of theories as to their merits, that we do go beyond saying, not slain yet. So he wanted to do justice to that, and he introduced the concept of corroboration. Now, this is not just some kind of semantic avoidance. He needed a word different from Carnap's preferred word, confirmation. And he also didn't like the firm part of that because it sounded like support, firming up, justifying, see. Corroboration. A theory is corroborated when it has been subjected to a test that hasn't been refuted. And the more risky the test to which you subjected it, the better it is corroborated, said Popper. So it went from the purely qualitative predicate, corroborated meaning not killed, although tested, to a kind of rough quantitative idea, not killed even though dangerously tested. Risky tested. He talked in terms of things like riskiness or a high hurdle or a strong test, potential refuter. And so he said, what we will say of a theory that it is very well corroborated when it has been subjected to a long string of very risky tests. Now, how do you decide how risky a test is? Popper didn't discuss that in the detail one might like, and it's quite hard to spell it out for all of the interesting cases that arise in science. His original notion was that you have to have some kind of a way of computing the prior probability, and here he used the word probability, the prior probability on the theory, and you want to pick the most improbable theories you can. Hardly anybody subscribes to that. I think that was a terrible mistake. I think that what you want is not to start looking at the most improbable theories you can, but look at the theories that predict the most improbable results that you can. The reason that Carnap made that mistake and Popper made that mistake, in my opinion, is that he was proceeding like a logician. And if you're a logician, you tend to define things, for instance, by the consequence class, that is, the infinite set of propositions that follow from your theory. And I think that's the wrong way to do it, and I'll tell you about my crazy way of doing it probably next time, which is totally unlike the logician's way, but I think better. He gave as examples of riskier tests mathematical functions which have fewer constants in them. That the more parameters you allow yourself, obviously, the more goofy points you can fit. And so you haven't corroborated much of anything if you allow enough parameters. The extreme case of that, that you probably, those of you who've had a college algebra course have been exposed to, is that if I give you, this is really absurd, if I give you x points in a two-space like that, and I tell you I'd like you to fit a curve to those data, we will require that the thing be at least single-valued so that there are no two different y's for a given x. We've got to hold that, otherwise we're in trouble. So we'll assume that the function is single-valued function in this general mathematician sense now. A point is associated with another coordinate. Well, you might say we know as a theorem of elementary algebra that we can write y equals b0 x plus, or b1 x plus b2 x squared plus b3 x cubed plus and so on. And it's a theorem of algebra that I can always fit a polynomial of n minus 1 degree to any set of n points. But of course, if I'm doing that, playing that kind of games, this damn thing is going all over here between the points. And that means that if I collected a set of k points and I fit this polynomial to them, now I go out and collect some more data and the new points don't fall anywhere near the curve that I drew. Well, nobody would do that. I mean, that's an act of madness. But that's an extreme case where Popper would say you do not subject your theory by saying, well, I think this function is a polynomial, and you don't say a polynomial of what degree, then you're not subjecting your pitiful theory to any strong test because you can always fit it as if you have enough parameters. We know, do we not, the kind of thing that impresses the scientist, even if he never heard of Karl Popper. What impresses the scientist is a numerical prediction of a point value or a very narrow range that pans out. And physicists and chemists and astronomers and then later geneticists were making that kind of argument long before anybody was reading Karl Popper. And the way they did it was to say things like, this theory is remarkably detailed in its predictions and in close accord with the facts. I mean, scientists were writing that way in 1650. This theory is remarkably detailed or remarkably accurate. And what does that amount to? Well, it amounts to saying, and I will explain more of this later when I get on my current crazy theory of corroboration, but it amounts to saying that we have some antecedent range of numerical values that we get from previous research or from common sense, common knowledge. And what the old German mathematicians, wow, that's aversive, isn't it? Called the Spielraum, the playroom, the elbow room, the movement room, huh? Play space, Spielraum. And if my theory says that the numerical value of this average IQ of these kids ought to be somewhere from here to here, you will not be bowled over by that. You would figure I had an even chance. And that's the main thing that's wrong with null hypothesis testing as a way of evaluating theories in psychology. Whereas if I said, well, I know what the Papa's IQ was, and the kid is, on the other hand, I know the foster father's IQ, and I know the biological mother's IQ, and then I know the IQ of two of the siblings and one uncle, and my particular theory about the genetics of intelligence tells me that kids in that situation I should be able to compute, and I say I expect this kid's IQ to be 118, and it turns out to be, then you will be more impressed, right? So what one of the most important ways, if not the most important way, in which a test is risky is if it carves out a narrow interval out of a larger interval which we know from common sense or previous knowledge or previous research, and we can say, well, IQs don't, there are no negative IQs, even the angleworm doesn't. What was it? Thorndike took the earthworm's IQ as zero for his scaling purposes, and there are no IQs above 200, and so that's our Spielraum, And so if I pick out a small interval, 118 plus or minus 1 for a certain mean of kids defined in a certain way, why, then that's rather impressive. Or the example I give in my Two Nights paper, Meal has cooked up a theory of weather. And I tell you, next April it's going to rain. It rains, yes. I say, next April it will rain on 7 days. And it does rain on 7 days. Well, you might perk up a little bit there, not much. I say, it's going to rain next April on the 3rd, the 5th, the 9th, the 11th, and it rains on those days and not the other days. Now you will really begin to be interested. And then I'll tell you, and on April 9th, it's going to rain 1.3 centimeters. And it does. And you will think, no matter how goofy my theory looked initially, I've really got onto something. What is that? It's just riskier and riskier and riskier test. The criterion here, is Wesley Salmon's rule or principle. He didn't call it his principle, but I've christened it the Salmon's principle. And that is the principle of the damn strange coincidence. In his writings, he merely refers to it as a highly improbable prediction, but at our conference on confirmation at the Philosophy of Science Center, he kept referring to his rule as the damn strange coincidence. If absent the theory, knowing simply roughly what range of values occurs in a certain domain, I am able to pick out a number, that would be a damn strange coincidence. Whereas if the theory is what enabled me to pick out a number, then we say, if I didn't have the theory, to pick that particular number out would be a damn strange coincidence. And so what then? That leads me to think that the theory took a very high risk because it picked out that narrow value, and consequently it is highly corroborated. Now, for our purposes as psychologists, it's sort of handy that two people who don't see eye to eye at all, namely Wesley Salmon, who is a Reichenbach PhD and an inductivist, and Sir Karl Popper, who doesn't believe there is such a thing as induction, and Salmon believes that you can attach probability numbers to theories, whereas Popper thinks that it's a logical and mathematical impossibility to even do that, and Salmon talks about support or confirmation, and Popper won't use those words. It turns out that Salmon's way of going about his confirmation thing gives us the same kind of answers that Popper's corroboration does. And that's reassuring. The way Salmon does it is by using Bayes' formula. Now, when the philosopher of science uses Bayes' theorem, you shouldn't think that he's always actually putting numbers in the way we learned in the stat class. It's a logical machinery thing. How many of you know what Bayes' formula is, by the way? Well, and I better, because we're going to be talking about it. And so I think we'll lick him. And if Grove comes in, he sure will. Yeah, we got to do that. I wasn't quite prepared to lecture on Bayes' formula. This is the Reverend Thomas Bayes, Anglican clergyman, and a discussion of Bayes' formula as applied to clinical problems. In my publication number 35, Neal and Rosen, Antecedent Probability, and so on. Well, I can't remember the date. I think it was 1736. It could be 1763. But in the 18th century, Thomas Bayes addressed himself to a certain problem in probability theory, and he was not happy with his assumptions. So he refrained from publishing it, and he died, and a friend of his published it. So it's a posthumous paper. And you hear the expression, I'm sure all of you have heard talk about Bayesian statistics. That's a particular position taken by statisticians in the field of statistical inference, and we're not going to talk about that in this class. But quite apart from the specific Bayesian position as regards statistical inference, which is a criticism of the Fisherian and of the Neyman-Pearson way of going about things, or even of the pure likelihood thing, this is more general. It isn't tied to the problem of statistical inference in the sense of the statistics course or statistics book. And it's general enough so it could be applied in epistemology without putting any numbers in. Some people think that's sinful, but others don't. Well, let's see. How do we explain Bayes' theorem? I'm not going to prove it. Although it's high school algebra. That's all it is. No calculus, no distribution assumptions, nothing like that. Suppose I tell you I have two urns. And each of them has a mixture of white and black marbles in it. And the probability, that is to say, the relative frequency of white marbles in the first urn we'll call P1, and the proportion of white marbles in the second urn we'll call P2. And we're first going to pick an urn by some randomizing procedure. And then after we have picked one of the urns, but you're not told which one, after we have picked one of the urns by some random procedure, we are going to pick a marble out of that urn randomly. And then we are going to inspect that marble and say it's white. And the question is, what urn did it come from? So that's a rather elementary and interesting question in the theory of probability. The probability of getting a white marble given the urn you're drawing from is a forward probability, and now we're going to do kind of a backward probability. That is, given that we drew a white marble, we're going to try to infer what urn it was drawn from. And suppose I tell you what these numbers are. I tell you that in deciding which urn to pick, we're going to use, say, a roulette wheel. And forget zero and double zero. At Vegas, the house gets that. We got a 36 thing. Numbers 1 to 12 on the wheel, you'll pick from the first urn. And numbers 13 through 36, you'll pick from the second urn. I tell you that's how I'm going to pick the urns. But you don't get to see the roulette wheel. I spin the roulette wheel. I look at what came up. And I pick one of the urns. And you don't know which one. And then I allow you to stick your fist in and pull out the marble. And you look, and it's white. And I've given you the p-values, and I've given you the p-values associated with the urns. How do you compute the probability that it was urn 1? Well, you have a big P called the prior probability of urn 1, which in this case is 1/3 because of the way I'm doing it on the roulette wheel. The prior probability that we have picked urn 1. And then Q is defined simply as the complement of that big P, which is the prior probability that we have picked urn 2. And P1 and P2 are called the conditional probabilities of white given which urn. conditional, that is, assuming I have been picking from the first urn, what's the probability I get a white marble? That's called conditional. It's conditional upon which urn we're monkeying with. And P2 is another conditional probability. It's the probability of getting a white marble if I am drawing out of the second urn. And those numbers are provided to you, you see. Now, having drawn an urn at random with the roulette wheel, and having drawn a marble out of it at random, and it, looking at it and then it's white, that's your fact, that's your little e in your evidence. Mighty slim, one piece of evidence, white marble. And now we want to compute the probability that the white marble came from urn number one. And that is called probability given the white that it came from urn number one. And that is called the posterior probability, meaning after the fact, or also the inverse probability, meaning backward instead of forward. Or it was, as it was called by Thomas Bayes and others following him, the probability of causes. You can see why you might say that if you think of, so to speak, the urn as the cause of getting a white marble. Then you've got two different possible causes of a white marble, namely the first urn and the second urn, and you're computing the probability of causes. And as I say, I'm not going to prove this, but if you want to, you can probably prove it in 10 minutes with a little algebra and set theory. The posterior probability, the probability that if I got a white marble, I got it from urn number one, is a simple fraction. Upstairs is P1, the prior probability of urn 1 times the conditional of a white marble on urn 1. Downstairs, that same thing recurs. And then the other term downstairs is big Q times P2. Now, that may or may not be intuitively obvious. Maybe you'll need to do the algebra to satisfy yourself that it's true. But one easy way to get the intuition is, what is this thing up here? Big P is the probability of drawing from urn 1. Little P1 is the probability, if you draw from urn 1, that you get a white one. So the product of those two, one of the fundamental axioms, is the probability that you drew from urn 1 and got a white one, right? Downstairs is the probability that you drew from urn 1 and got a white one, plus the probability that you drew from the other urn and got a white one. And that's the only two possibilities, because you got a white one. So this is the probability that you got a white one drawing from the first urn, and this is the probability that you got a white one, period. And the ratio of the probability that you got it from the first urn to getting a white one is the probability of the first urn on having got a white one, okay? That's the best I can do intuitively with it. The reason that that's important to the clinician, P1 is the conditional probability of a certain symptom or a certain Rorschach sign or a certain multiphasic pattern on being a schizophrene. In my clinic, 40% of the patients are schizophrenes. Then I want to know the inverse probability that if somebody who gets this Rorschach sign or shows this symptom is a schizophrene. I do it by Bayes' theorem. Your doctor does this all the time, even if he never heard of Bayes' theorem. I mean, you come in and you've got, feel kind of crummy and you get a little hoarse and you have a low-grade fever or maybe no fever at all if it's a viral thing, and he listens to your complaints and pounds you and so forth and decides you haven't got the galloping con or anything, and he says, well, I think you've got the spring crud. There's a lot of that going around. You've heard your doctor say that. That's Bayes' theorem, see? That's Bayes' theorem. There's a high prior on the crud. For a young person without a previous history who comes in and says, I feel crummy, my head hurts, and he does through all the things, excludes a bunch of things, but he relies upon the prior probability, big P, being a big one. So people use Bayes' theorem all the time, whether they know it or not, although, as the decision theory guys have shown, Tversky and Kalman and others have shown, they don't use it very accurately, but let's not go into that one. All right, that's Bayes' formula. Now, when you Bayesianize when you Bayesianize the test of scientific theories, you have a certain prior on the theory, says Wesley Salmon, and your theory implies strongly a certain fact, meaning P1 is big. But without your theory, and this is left as a blank now, this is not the competing theory, it's just sort of the world, unspecified. Without your theory, we will say that the chance that you could guess that IQ or that charge on the electron with that precision is fairly small. We don't know exactly how small, but because you zeroed in on a narrow range of the Spielraum, we will say that this little P2 on alternative states of the world is rather small, and that means that this big thing dominates things, and that means that this ratio is big, and that means that your theory is well supported. So Wesley Salmon, starting with a probability concept and believing in induction, and even saying you want the prior on the theory to be big, whereas Popper says you want the prior on the theory to be small, oddly enough, they both come to the same conclusion that you want risky tests. Popper refers to tough tests, risky tests. Wesley Salmon refers to getting a damn strange coincidence. There are a number of philosophers of science who rely on the Bayes theorem approach. The debate continues as to whether you can do it that way, but it's not just disciples of Reichenbach. There are quite a few people writing philosophy of science who do it that way, and I repeat, it's not that they say they actually know how to compute numerical values. They say if we had the thing worked out enough in detail, we'd be able to compute numerical values. They say all I'm really doing is showing the logical structure. Big prior, low conditional probability on one theory, bigger conditional probability on another. All right. I'm not going to talk about Popper's verisimilitude concept. I'll leave that for next time. Popper students that I have had a lot of contact with and whose names will come up again and again are Paul K. Feyerabend, I think I mentioned him last time, Crazy Paul, PK, who we hired here at the Philosophy of Science Center 1 year, and he was all set to come, and he called Feigl up long distance and said, I can't come because I can't bear to leave my singing teacher, so, which was the true story. So he stayed. He likes to sing opera. He stayed in Berkeley. And he has written a blast against practically any effort to reconstruct science rationally, and if you want to rattle your cage, you read his book called Against Method. The man is a little nuts, but terribly smart, and nuts in a creative way. So needless to say, he doesn't get popular among the philosophers of science because writing a treatise called Against Method is essentially to say that their whole intellectual enterprise is bankrupt and they should do something else, make an honest living, selling shoes or something. Secondly, Imre Lakatos. Did I mention him last time? Imre Lakatos he died of an aneurysm at age 51 or so. And he was doing, at the time of his death, what many people view, not just for sentimental reasons because the guy died, as some of the most interesting creative work in philosophy of science. And his collected works, including some things that were not published in his lifetime, have been put together by students of his, and you can find 2-volume paperback of Lakatos' writings probably in any of the good bookstores around. Imre Lakatos was a Hungarian communist, fairly high up in the party, who became disillusioned. He was a Stalinist, and he became disillusioned when he found himself shooting the students and the workers for Khrushchev, and described, when I once asked him, what are your present views, he said, slightly right of Tory, and he was. We had some terrible t- terrible drunken debates over the Vietnam War, where I was a dove and he was a hawk. And Lakatos, becoming disillusioned with communism and Marxism, had to make a new career for himself, so he became a philosopher of science. He left Hungary under a cloud and went to the university, the London School of Economics, where he took a PhD, I think with Popper. If not with Popper, at least he was one of the Popper's students. So he's the only person I have known actually personally who has had people shot. He didn't pull the trigger himself, but he said, oh, yes, yes, I gave the order, shoot Fisbee, bing. Terribly smart man, and the stuff he writes is very creative, original, and I recommend him to you. He, like Feyerabend, was at first greatly influenced by Popper and then deviated increasingly from Popper's view. Not as strongly as Feyerabend, who says there's no such thing as scientific method, Popper's or anybody else's, but Lakatos amending Popper in a way that many of us felt before Lakatos was around is the right way, that somebody needed to amend it. The most important way he amended is softening the blow of the modus tollens and trying to say something helpful and constructive about the business of scientific tenacity. That is, under what conditions should you cling to the theory? And his approach is, and we'll say more about this later too, but basically his approach was to refer to not individual theories, but what he called research programs, which meant a succession of amended theories, starting out with certain leading ideas. And he made a distinction between modifications in a theory into a new theory, T prime and then T double prime, modifications which met certain conditions and those which didn't. I guess I don't really have time to go into the conditions, but those that, though, if your modification of one theory into another one and that into a third one and that into a fourth one was still animated by certain core ideas and met these methodological constraints, he referred to that as a progressive research program. As Feyerabend says, his old Leninism shows up in the way he thinks, and which it does, even the combative language about scientists and so forth. And whereas, if your modifications didn't meet these methodological conditions, he referred to as a degenerating program. So you have two kinds of research programs. One is going, and the other one is going to pot. And to that extent, he was more of a Kuhnian than a Popperian. That is, he said that what for Kuhn is normal science means a progressive research program, fixing up anomalies, solving puzzles, whereas when we reach the stage of degeneration, the time is ripe for a revolution, a Kuhnian revolution, meeting the conditions. As you recall, Lenin had certain conditions for a revolution and said that if those were met, you were a reformist if you didn't take them. Whereas if you tried to make one when those conditions were not present, you were an adventurist. So one is an error, a deviation of the right, and the other is a deviation of the left. You have to have widespread disaffection. You have to have a loss of faith in the ruling class that they will are entitled and they are able to continue ruling. You have to have disaffection among the military because since the machine gun, you can't do the barricades business anymore. None of this French Revolution stuff, you know. And you have to have an organized, determined revolutionary cadre. And he said, when you meet those conditions, then you should make a revolution. And if you don't meet, if any one of them is missing, then it's adventurism to try. Well, coming from that intellectual heritage, you see, it was natural for Lakatos to use the kind of words he does and to think the way he does. And his position differs markedly from the position of the positivists, whose reconstruction was not at all diachronic. They paid no attention to the time sequence. For Lakatos, that's crucial. The way in which science is going, whether you have been doing well and now are falling on your face, which falsifiers came before the refuters and so forth, before the corroborators. The time sequence is critical in his way of analyzing it, and therefore he thought that study of the history of science was very important for the philosopher, whereas Carnap and the Vienna positivists paid very little attention, as I think I mentioned last time, to the historical aspect. Now, the one respect in which Popper pays attention to the time sequence is the emphasis on prediction. And I think I will do that and then quit. I still got a little more history, but you're getting some content here with the history. The sense in which Popper emphasized the time sequence is that he believes that a theory's ability to predict a new fact is far more important than its ability to explain an old one. Far more important. And the interesting thing is that every working scientist that you ask about this, whether it's a social scientist or a biologist or a chemist, I've never asked anybody this, whether he ever heard of Popper. He could be uninterested in philosophy. Which situation would give you more faith in your theory? Case one, you had three facts, and you contemplated those three facts, and you whomped up T. And you can show that T logically entails, stronger than the horseshoe, therefore, the turnstile, or the hook, T logically entails facts F1, 2, and 3. Or suppose you had the same theory and the same facts, but the time sequence was different. Namely, you had F1 and F2, and you sat around and reflected on those two facts, and you whomped up T. And then you realized that T was capable of deducing a new fact, F3, and you went into the lab and found it. So that the logical structure is absolutely identical. We're not talking about two different theories. We're talking about the same theory and the same three facts. But the situations differ. And here we had F1, 2, 3 and cooked up T to explain it. Here we had F1 and F2 and cooked up T to explain them. And we realized T entailed F3, and there, behold, it was in the lab. I never met a scientist who didn't say, well, of course I'd have more faith than this. And you say, well, why? Well, predicted this new fact. I mean, that's obvious. Dope, you predicted a new fact. Believe it or not, Rudolf Carnap never admitted this. Never admitted this. Last time I argued with Carnap in his place in Venice, California, I gave the Popper thing, and he looks at me and he says, Miel, what difference could it make in the logical structure what the date of a fact is? And of course, when you put it that way, it is a little funny. The logical structure. Well, the answer to that is that something more is involved in the logical structure. That's all one can say. I mean, if the logician cannot explain why the working scientist prefers to predict new facts than merely explain old ones, then my current attitude is very high-handed, and I tell him, well, you better go back to the drawing board, buddy, because what you're claiming to, as a philosopher of science or logician, you're claiming to give a rational reconstruction of how science really works, and this, damn it, is how it really works, and if you can't reconstruct how it really works in this difference between the dates, then there's something wrong with your reconstruction. Today, I think practically all philosophers of science concede the point that prediction is a more, ceteris paribus, prediction is a more powerful corroborator than post hoc explanation. The problem is to say exactly why. And that is not easy. That is not easy. So there's a portion of Popper that involves the diachronic element, but not as strongly as Lakatos, for whom the diachronic element is critical. It's not just a little extra something. It's whether the theory was doing well and is now going to pot that counts in deciding you have now a degenerating program and it's time for a revolution. Okay, let's let it go at that.